don't understand. I could have had class. I could have been a contender. I could have been somebody.
So he's almost like having a second captain in the team.
Second captain, first captain, whatever.
Spider Stacey of Pogues kicked off her latest series in some style last week. Today's contestant is one of Ireland's greatest writers, Joseph O'Connor. Now, we know the pen is mightier than the sword, but is it also mightier than the tin whistle? That's just one of the burning questions you're going to have answered on this afternoon's episode of Second Captain Saturday.
That is a question I've never wrestled with before, Owen.
Owen McDevitt here with Ciarán Murphy. There's no doubt Joseph is one of the great ones, Murph.
Absolutely. He's written 11 acclaimed novels. He's won the Unpus Novel of the Year for Shadowplay. His novel, Star of the Sea, sold more than 1 million copies on, and he's currently Professor of Creative Writing at UL, where he teaches alongside writers like Donal Ryan. He's got some game. That's what I'm trying to say.
Okay. He's put together some literary masterpieces. That's all fine and good, but for me, his greatest achievement will always be his 1994 Sunday Tribune World Cup diary. Nobody has ever captured the magic at that time quite like this man, when he travelled to America to document the adventures of the Irish supporters in all their joyous, boisterous, sometimes X-rated glory, as you'll soon hear. This is all grist to the mill when it comes to Joseph staking his claim for the second captain's greatest non-sportsperson sportsperson prize of 2025.
I could have been a contender. I could have been somebody.
Well, Owen, Spider Stacey got the ball rolling for this season with an average to below average opening gambit of 74 points last week. If Joseph O'Connor can get over 80 points, he's got a chance of a podium finish. And if he gets close to the score of his fellow man of letters, Richard Ford, then he's got a shot at the overall title for, as you say, our greatest non-sportsperson sportsperson of 2025. Ford ended up with 85 points after telling us about meeting Muhammad Ali and catching one-handed a screaming line drive from legendary second baseman Ryan Sandberg in Wrigley Field in Chicago. What Joseph has got in store for us, we're about to find out on.
Get in touch with us by email, editor@secondcaptains.com or @secondcaptains on Instagram. Joseph O'Connor will be joining us in studio in just a couple of minutes. But first up, we want to dedicate this one to Sean Rocks. It's Janice Ian with @17, a song mentioned by Sean just a couple of months ago in the Irish Examiner. He talked about Janice Ian's performance at Tradfest in 2024 as one of the greatest gigs he'd ever seen, describing the joy he felt at sitting just a few feet away as she sang the opening lyrics, "I learned the truth at 17. Our love to all Sean's friends and family.
I learned the truth, it said.
Janice Ian with @17 for the late Sean Rocks there. Now, Joseph O'Connor is an international best-selling author, a master of historical fiction, who's been honoured for his outstanding contribution to Irish literature. Is it an exaggeration to say he owes it all to the Irish football fan who brought along a sex doll to the 1994 World Cup group stage match against Norway in Giant Stadium? We'll soon find out. Joseph O'Connor, welcome to studio.
It's a great pleasure. Thanks for bringing back that lovely memory.
I have to say, just by dint of the fact that you covered USA 94 for the Sunday Tribune, you're already in the running here for top spot, I got to say. How did you end up with that gig in the first place?
I can claim no credit for the idea. I was working as a columnist for the Sunday Tribune. I was living over in London, sending in a column once a week. And the World Cup came along, and Vincent Brown, who was the editor of the Tribune at the time, who was always very kind to me, came up with this brilliant idea, which is that all of the sports, all of the major Irish media outlets and newspapers, everybody's going to be sending their serious, heavy-duty sports guys, and they usually were guys at the time. And he said, how about I find the biggest football eejit in Ireland and send him somebody who knows absolutely nothing about football, preferably has never been to a game. So you were the obvious candidate. So he said that he wanted me to go and embed myself with the fans and go to the matches and hang around afterwards and just, you know, try and capture the circus of it more than the actual games.
A loose enough brief then, it wasn't any more specific than
brief.
That.
Whatever you see, whatever you think is going to be interesting that a sports writer is not going to be writing about. Here's your tickets, here's your flight, here's your hotel voucher. And I can remember sitting in a pub in Dublin the night before I went, literally wondering, like, am I going to do this? Because I really wasn't a soccer fan. And my friends who were sitting in the pub going, like, are you mad, you know? Anyway, the next morning, 6 o'clock out to Dublin Airport, into the terminal, a sea of Irish manhood in green afro wigs getting stuck into the pints at 6 o'clock in the morning, and me in the middle of it all, trying not to be noticed, like Ross O'Carroll Kelly, wedging myself into the, you know, surrounded by all the lads. And off he went. And it was a wonderful experience. I mean, it was one of the great highlights of my life as a writer, because it just proved to be such an incredibly enjoyable experience, not just with the fans. I mean, if you had to single out one sporting occasion that you would never forget, it would be our opening game against Italy, when we all went into the stadium. There's 70,000 people and it looks like a home game. I mean, the vast number of Irish and Italian tricolours, and I think it was important, these two big New York Irish immigrant communities having this match that was like a coming of age. And then, as you remember, I think we scored in the 6th or 7th or 8th.
It's very early anyway, yeah. Minute,
and then the sound of 60,000 Irish fans just hoping that nothing will happen now. You know, there's a great play by T.S. Eliot, Murder in the Cathedral, where the Greek chorus says from time to time, "We hope that nothing will happen." And that's what it was like in the stadium that day. And it was unforgettable. I mean, it was a great, great moment. I was there with my dad and there were friends there, and everybody in Irish New York seemed to bump into each other that day. It was a great moment and a great month. And a wonderful part of my writing life.
It was a different time, it's fair to say, Joseph. You were you leave Shannon to head over to New York, head straight down the back of the plane to have a smoke, yeah, as was the style at the time.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the Shannon stopover is, that's exactly, yeah, its time as well.
No smartphones back then, obviously, so people weren't at that point documenting every second of an experience like that, as they would be now if we ever get back to a major tournament. So were they happy? Were the fans happy for you to be in amongst it, reporting on their shenanigans?
They were initially, as quite rightly, a little bit suspicious, wondering, like, what's this guy doing here? But they became incredibly welcoming very quickly. What happened was, because we survived, we stayed in the States for a while, another wave of fans came out, and they had brought the Sunday Tribune with them with my stuff in it. So I was rumbled pretty quickly, and they couldn't have been more welcoming. They would practically queue up outside my hotel room every morning to give me funny stories that had happened to them. It's funny you were talking about the technology back then, because I was thinking today, just coming in to see you, I remember being on a payphone in the stadium after the Ireland-Italian match, and I had written a bit of my piece, handwritten it on a sheet of A4, and phoning it in to Ger Siggins, who was the sports guy back in the Sunday Tribune, and feeding the phone with like quarters. I missed the bus back into Manhattan, so I walked all the way back into Manhattan. Oh, wow. But a famous day and a wonderful experience.
Wow, and you know, this is kind of even pre-Celtic Tiger, like that idea that, you know, you'd go to New York for the Christmas shopping, you know? Like, this was, in 1994 even, like, once-in-a-lifetime stuff for the fans.
You
know,
was,
and, you know, potentially ruinous to their personal finances, as you discover talking to them as well. But it was a huge occasion and a thing that they just were going to do for the rest of their lives. That it was a memory that would last them the rest of their lives.
Well, that's what happened in my case, and in the case of everybody who I know was there. They would still talk about that whole experience, and in particular that day. I think it was a kind of coming of age. It was an arrival on the international stage. It was definitely to do with the fact that, as I say, these are two big immigrant communities to the States who had had their problems, had had their ups and downs in the US.
Yeah. Did you feel like a bit of a fish out of water? You've already mentioned kind of Ross O'Carroll Kelly. Was there like kind of a class element to that fish out of water feeling?
I don't know if it was that. It's just that, like, Irish football fans, and I think Dublin football fans in particular, have a thing that to be a fan is not enough. You're a football person.
Yeah.
You know, and that means that you have an MA and a PhD in football, and it's in your veins.
Yeah.
And one of your ancestors dug the first sod of turf at Bowes.
Yeah.
And if you don't have that, like, we're not interested. And I didn't have that. I went to a rugby playing school, which I didn't particularly like. Speaking of class, I think it was an interesting thing that if you went to one of those schools in Dublin, they tended to play rugby and not much else. Mm. And I can remember a kid in the school one day putting up his hand and saying, "Father, why don't we play soccer?" And the priest said, well, it's soccer's for different sort of boys to us. Okay. Yeah. And then another kid said, Father, why don't we play Gaelic? Oh, no, they play Gaelic in a different kind of school than this. So you see how sport is part of ideology.
Yeah.
And they would say, we are Blackrock College, we play rugby. And rugby has a lot to teach you about life. And he wasn't entirely wrong, because rugby, like life, is sometimes painful and boring, punctuated by moments of brilliance.
And the odd scrum.
The main thing that I learned from that was... rugby is like life in the sense that you realise quickly that the purpose of a school like that is that the country will be run by people who go to schools like this. Mm. And that's the main thing it taught. And that Ireland certainly did have a class system. And it wasn't that it was invisible. You just have to look twice and there it was. So, you know, I'm interested in how sports have meanings and ideologies as well as just being sports.
You were looking for colour in the USA that summer, and you certainly got it. The fans didn't let you down over there, Joseph. For example, this gent at the Norway match, who you describe at the time as a prime specimen of the best of Jackie's army, lurching up the steps before the game. Bearing in mind, you're already sitting beside a pair of American psychiatrists who are there just taking in soccer, maybe for the very first time.
Taking notes as well, I would say.
Our man bounds up anyway. He is naked from the waist up. He has thick green concentric circles painted around his nipples, a green nose painted on his torso, and a leering green mouth painted around his navel, which is pierced with a ring so big that even the Pope would find it a bit OTT. As soon as I see him, I just know he is destined for the seat beside me.
Yeah. No, that's right. Funny enough, about 2 years ago, that man's daughter wrote to me.
No!
Seriously. Say, what a kick he got out of it. But I mainly remember the look of chilled fear on the faces of the American psychiatrist, who I've no doubt got a PhD out of observing the Irish team.
He ends up berating the Norwegian fans in front of him with the
Swedish
chef. Not the Norwegian chef, the Swedish chef impression from the...
Swedish chef. Yeah. It's a wonderful example of international outreach brotherhood, as provided so often
by
sport.
I'm glad this man was happy with his portrayal in his diaries.
I'm struggling to see what he could have been chuffed about.
Well, sure, immortalisation.
Completely.
And they're all there in the secret world of the Irish Mail. And I was very touched that a number of years ago, the Faber book of 20th century reportage came out. And it has incredible pieces of journalism in it by George Orwell. Olivia O'Leary's unforgettable account of the fall of the generals in Argentina, and wedged in the middle, there's my account of going to Disney World with the Irish fans on a morning when they're all hungover.
Who are we to cast aspersions?
Taken as a whole month, it was an unforgettable experience, and I learned an awful lot, and I'm very, very grateful to the fans who welcomed this complete and utter tyro into their ranks.
What did you learn then, Joseph? You said you learned a lot from that summer.
The thing that you would have a real sense of coming back to it, coming back from it, is what sport means to people who are not necessarily sports people themselves and who don't play themselves, but how it's to do with belonging and how it's to do with a culture and a celebration. And it reminded me of how I lived in South London for 9 years, South East London, where people supported Millwall. And I was trying to be a freelance journalist at the time, so I had a bit of time on my hands. And in the afternoons, I'd go down to the pub, the Amersham Arms in New Cross, and there'd be three old lads sitting at the bar pretty much every day. I'm sure they were retired stevedores or dockers, there were a lot of them in that part of town, and they were Millwall through and through. And the slogan, the great chant of Millwall fans, as you know, is, we are Millwall, super Millwall, no one likes us, we don't care. Which, when you're that age, is kind of so remarkably punk rock.
Yeah.
And they'd sit at the bar like three lads in a Samuel Beckett play, and the telly would be on, and I would be... There was no phone in the flat, so I used to go to the pub to use the phone or play pool, sometimes with one of these three lads. And they were very pleasant lads. One of them, when he would go home of an evening, would stand up and go, no one likes us, we don't care. See you tomorrow, lads. And it gave me, I thought of it sometimes during the Irish jaunt to the States, because I came to understand that whole thing about Millwall was really about a kind of self-defense and a kind of establishment of community. Because, like, since the days of Dickens, there's been a sort of hatred of the urban working class among the commentariat, who ascribe to them failings that they very much have themselves, including racism. Mm-hmm. And I think this was Millwall's way of saying, you can say what you like, we're thick and thin, Millwall. Mm-hmm. Whereas John Lydon used to say about his own supporting of Arsenal, he was proper Arsenal. It doesn't matter if Arsenal win or lose, I'm proper Arsenal. So I think sport does provide that community sense of belonging, somewhere usually safe to put those feelings of loyalty. Now, it boils over.
Yeah.
And it did in Millwall from time to time. Certainly not perfect. But I think slagging them off, you'd wonder sometimes why they would be singled out. And maybe it was a way of not having to talk about the institutionally racist, misogynist, corrupt metropolitan police force, or racism in government, or racism in media. This is still an era in the UK when there's literally the black and white minstrel show on the BBC, and people are having a go at Millwall for racism. Yeah. So I think it was their way of saying, you know, say what you want, our loyalty is not going to be dented.
Yeah, and for all the fun that you had, the diaries end with this beautiful scene in Orlando of the Irish fans and the Dutch fans singing Dancing in the Moonlight by Thin Lizzy.
Yeah.
And you find it, as you write, unforgettably moving.
Yeah.
And that's it, isn't it? That, like, that for all, you know, it had been a long 3 weeks or whatever, and then suddenly this feeling of...
For all the kind of circus and the green wigs and the blow-up dolls and the nonsense and all the rest of it, at the same time, you'd be very struck by the multi-generational aspect of it. The number of parents with kids who went, the number of parents or brothers and sisters or boyfriends and girlfriends who went over to the States and reunited with people there, and how sport, like it does at its best, is actually an occasion for what's happening off the pitch. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a way of bringing people together. There's a kind, even in the debased era of money and agents and drugs and all of the caveats that we would all have about sport, at its heart, there's a kind of innocence. At its heart, there's a kind of play. And it's something that you do with your mates or your loved or your loved ones. Very few people would go to a soccer match or a rugby game or a cricket match by themselves. It's something you do as much so that you can talk about it on the way home as for what you actually experienced when you were there. So it's a bit like literature in that sense. It's a bit like the arts. And I think there's a lot of crossover between what an artist does and what a sports person does.
What's it a crossover?
It's to do with storytelling. It's to do with shared experience. The greatest thing about reading a novel is to be able to talk about it with somebody who's read the same thing. It's like you were at the same game. You watch the same match. You have different insights into it. Your commentary or your analysis on it is as different as Richie Sadler's might be from whoever else's, you know, on that night. It gives us something to commune about that at heart has a kind of innocence that's to do with play. And it's the same with fiction. I mean, if you think about what an adult does reading a novel, right, you are agreeing with the person who wrote the novel to engage with this thing that never happened. You know, it's a game. But the deal is the writer does the work with as much skill and passion as they can bring to it. And the reader says, well, okay, I'll turn up, I'll buy my ticket, I'll be in the stands and let's see what the result is. It's often there in a very direct way in the work of, I think, commentators, particularly commentators on the radio, you know, the beautiful phraseology that is required to summon up what's often a very visual thing on the radio. I have lovely memories of, as a kid, going to stay with both sets of my grandparents. I mentioned my dad was born in Francis Street in the Liberties, but at some point they moved out to Keeper Road in Crumlin. My dad lived in number 77. My mother lived in 248, same road. And I remember often going to stay with both of them. But one particular summer, it might have been 1974, staying in my maternal granny's house. And there was a big radiogram, old-fashioned radio, the size of an upright piano. And there was a glass screen on the front of it with place names of exotic cities all over the world. Moscow and Hilversum and Lille and Warsaw. exciting places that you could turn the dial to. And her, in her entire life, I never saw it moved off Radio Éireann. And it was one particular summer when the Dublin Horse Show was on, and the two of us just listened over kind of 3 days to a man, the great Noel Andrews, later a boxing commentator as well, and he described every horse and every rider and every fence that fell and every cheer from the crowd. And I mean, I saw them. You know, I actually saw them. It's the great Eddie Mackin. I remember well, there was one by a remarkable man called Captain Raimondo Dinzeo, who was a captain in the Italian cavalry, later a general, General Raimondo Dinzeo. And in his spare time, he was a world champion show jumper. It was like a figure out of a Gabriel Garcia Marquez novel. And I mean, I never saw him with my eyes modestly receiving his trophy, but I certainly saw it through the words of Noel Andrews. So, you know, it's I think it is a remarkable skill. And George Hamilton, you know, a nation holds its breath. I think Yeats would have gnawed his own leg off to have written that. So, you know, the use of words, the use of flamboyance, descriptiveness in language, but also, as I say, just the territory of the novel or the poem, which is about an innocence at heart. And I think that, that under all of the crap, that's still there in sport at its best.
The stories that you told back then ended up in The Secret World of the Irish Mail, which is the best-selling book in Ireland in 1994. So did your experiences in the US help set you on your way to where you've ended up getting to?
I think yes and no. I mean, you know, at the time I was trying to write very kind of serious, intense, poignant novels, no doubt drawing from my difficult childhood. So I'd turn up in Waterstones in Athlone or Easton's in Galway to read, you know, from one of these novels, and there'd be a big crowd and people would shuffle up and at the end and say, now that's great, that's beautiful what you read there, but do you know what you wrote that's really good? It's that stuff about going to Disney World and rides and Mickey's. God, it's fabulous. You should do a lot more of that. So for a couple of years I was a bit embarrassed by it, and now I'm not. I mean, I'm so proud of it. I'm so happy and glad that I was there, and it was a lovely thing to be there with my dad. As I mentioned, my dad was a big sports guy in his childhood. From Francis Street, as I say, but he was the junior national title holder in the 400 metres, won the Guinness 100, ran the first Dublin Marathon, ran the first London Marathon in 3 hours and 11 minutes.
3 hours, 11
Tasty
minutes.
Time.
Yeah, and his brother Tommy, my uncle Tommy, played in a junior league on trial with Ipswich for a while, and the manager of Ipswich at the time was Alf Ramsey. So I had an uncle who worked with Alf Ramsey, and Billy's daughter Donna, who is no mean athlete herself as a kid, now works as a nutritionist with the Australian Olympic team. So despite not being a sporting fellow myself, I have a bit of it in my background. I'm very proud to have it.
Without breaking confidences, Joseph, when we got in touch first, was like, I'd love to do it. I'm just not quite sure if I have enough sporting background. It's like, oh, you've got quite a lot there. We'll get back to that a little later on. I do want to talk a bit about where your career went and ultimately into historical fiction, The Star of the Sea. Was that all part of that same idea of wanting to get into, I don't know if the word serious writing is the best way to put it?
I don't make that distinction now. You know, as far as I'm concerned, I like storytelling. That's what I do. I've come to a point where I don't see any difference between that and writing Star of the Sea, which is a novel about the Irish famine. In some ways, two works in which America is important, you know, in different keys. One is in a minor key and the other is full on heavy metal with the Irish fans. But I tell stories and I use words to try and do that. And it was to have some understanding of sport was very important for the last two novels that I've written, My Father's House and The Ghosts of Rome, which are based on a real person, Hugh O'Flaherty from Kerry, who was a very keen sports person himself.
There's a great interview in the Irish Times I read recently with one of Ireland's leading authors who spoke of his deep loathing of historical fiction. Let me see who said it. It was Joseph O'Connor, February 2025.
I stand to it. I mean, in a way, I think only people who dislike a genre should be allowed to write in it. Like, I think only people who don't like Tolkien should be allowed to write about hobbits, because it rescues you from cliche. It means that what you're bringing to it is your own take. It's not inheriting what historical novelists have done before.
It's difficult to work. It's difficult to work in something you loathe, though. Is it? This is you used to loathe it and have come to love.
I don't read much historical fiction myself. It isn't a genre that I like. I mean, I find that
that's incredible.
It's sometimes, you know, it can be a little bit over-researched.
Yes.
So, like, you're on page 6 or 8, and you're just beginning to engage with the characters and how they talk and the landscape. It's lovely. And then suddenly it's like this, everything stops and there's a PowerPoint demonstration about how awful dentistry was in 1820 or how interesting footwear was in 1921. And you know what's happened is the author has happened across really interesting article in the National Library. And I'm like, I'm really
just
into
You just research. Can't avoid it.
I love that. But it's very important that you leave the research out because we don't go to the novel for that. You know, I love reading history books. I love reading journalism and politics. But the novel is about an experience of empathy. And to write a novel that works, it's really to do with evoking feelings in the reader of being able to empathise with those characters. And research can only help you so much when it comes to that.
And I suppose then the challenge of writing about real people, you can't be kind of hidebound or you can't be cowed by the idea that, okay, I'm writing about people, but I'm not in a position to be able to give these people dialogue that they would have said. So
there's a moral ambiguity in that.
Yeah.
And you have to be very aware of it. And you have to make it very clear, as I always do in the kind of afterword, is that they are novels. They're works of fiction, first and last. And I write them out of an experience of having researched people, but I can't know. And if the person who I'm writing about has written a book themselves, or if one of their loved ones has, I always direct the reader to that. But for example, with Hugh O'Flaherty, right, so you're saying writing a novel about a very heroic priest who lived in the Vatican during World War II. I mean, I could, and for a while I did, call him, you know, Father Lou O'Doherty from Carlow instead of Monsignor Hugh O'Flaherty from Kerry. And my publisher said to me, but if you're doing it as a tribute to him, should we just call him? We'll actually use his name. What better tribute could there be than that? So the all of the characters in my books are fictional, but some of them have the same names as real people. That's how I put it. And if I use a real name, it's usually because I want to honour the person who I'm writing about. And that's certainly the case with Hugh.
You're completing a trilogy of books set in Nazi-occupied Rome and World War II at the moment. That's something we'll get into after the break. We might just dip back into those USA 94 diaries before the show is out with Joseph O'Connor on Second Captain Saturday.
Second Captain, First Captain, whatever.
Joseph O'Connor is our guest on Second Captain Saturday, the one-time chronicler of the adventures of Irish football fans. He's dedicated a good chunk of his recent career to writing about life in Rome during World War II, and specifically an Irish priest you mentioned by the name of Monsignor Hugh O'Flaherty, who, if people don't know the story, saved the lives of thousands of people by organising an escape line out of the city. When did you first become aware of this incredible figure in Irish history?
Years and years ago, the first literary festival that I ever went to was before I'd published anything. I was living over in London, writing the odd bit for the Tribune, when not going down to the Amersham Arms with the Millwall fans. There was a competition in a newspaper called The Irish Post, which is for Irish immigrants to the UK. And it was a short story competition. And the prize was a trip to Listowel Writers Week. And I entered and I didn't win. And one day I trudged back to the bedsit. And there was a note from John B. Keane saying, you didn't win, but you're so what? Come over, and you're an O'Connor, and Kerry's full of O'Connors, and I'm married to an O'Connor. You probably are the heir to Carrigafoyle Castle. Come on over. So I went over, had a great time. It's a very warm, welcoming festival. And at some point over the weekend, somebody told me this about this remarkable man from Kerry, born in Cork, it's important to say. Always identified as a Kerry man, and born in Cork, 1898, brought up in Killarney, became a school teacher, and 100 years ago this year was ordained a Catholic priest. He was a bright, scholarly man. He spoke 6 or 7 languages. He had 3 doctorates in the course of his life, and he was invited to go over and work in Rome in the Curia in the Vatican. And he realised, as the Nazis invaded Rome, The Vatican is an independent country, technically. It became independent in 1929. It was neutral during the Second World War. It's like an enclave in the middle of Rome. And Hugh realised that if he could put together a group of helpers, he could smuggle fugitives from the Nazis into the Vatican. Some of them were Jews. Most of them were escaped Allied prisoners of war. A very interesting thing in itself, given that Hugh was from Republican North Kerry, very strong memories of the Black and Tans. He was appointed a papal visitor to the fascist prisoner of war camps, the length and breadth of Italy. And he just identifies with these young men from England who are British soldiers, young working class lads, often still in their teens, from Liverpool or Coventry or Manchester or London, some of them with Irish names. And he just decides, I'm going to help as many of these people as he possibly could. So his work was done in secret. We'll never know the numbers for sure. Some people have estimated that he saved 7,000 lives. He was an extremely modest man, never talked about his work after the war. Through the great graciousness and generosity of his family, they have allowed me to read every surviving word that Hugh O'Flaherty wrote, his letters and his journals. His journalism, he actually wrote a newspaper column for the Daily Express after the war. He was a good writer, very kind of witty, very observant, good eye. And one of the things that struck me about him in the course of that was his great completeness as a person, in that he loved his God and the holy books and religion, and he loved food and Rome and walking around Rome, looking at people and listening to the opera, and a great gift for friendship and a huge love of sports.
Oh, yeah.
Loved boxing, loved cycling, in the way that some Italians have, you know, they have that kind of completeness about life. Really endearing when he's writing letters back to Killarney to his loved ones and family. Sometimes he says, I'm enclosing a postal order for five bob. Would you get me a few tickets for the Irish hospital sweepstake and send them over? It's like the greatest sin that this man ever committed. And I'm sure if he'd won, he would have given the money to the poor. And I have an image of him late at night. You weren't allowed to have a radio in Nazi-occupied Rome, but people used to build their own radios from kind of crystals and wires and bits of wood. And Hugh loved the boxing, and I have an image of him in his room in the college in the Vatican with the homemade radio, listening to the bouts in Madison Square Gardens. And he absolutely loved sports, particularly boxing. And I think it's just part of his persona that makes him the very likable man that he was. So it's all there in My Father's House and The Ghosts of Rome. So sport is definitely a factor in these books.
What drove all these people to risk their lives in the way that they did, do you think?
I think with Hugh, it was just a kind of stubborn moral compass that wouldn't be altered. The person he reminds me of in our own era is Nelson Mandela, who said to white South Africa, well, look, you do your thing. You know, if you have to put me in a prison cell for 26 years, you do that. I'm not going to stop what I'm doing. But I think Hugh had that. I think, I don't know, maybe it's Kerry. He was just stubborn. I think when he was admonished by the authorities, as he certainly was, not just the authorities in the Vatican, but the government back in Dublin, who are running a neutral country. We don't want any of our citizens involved in any of this stuff. I think he probably would have agreed. Like, what comes across from his letters is that he's not a kind of father, trendy, liberation theologian guy. He's an old-fashioned, very conservative, obedient priest. And I think if God himself had appeared to Hugh and said, stop doing what you're doing, Hugh wouldn't have been able to. I think it was the Kerry in him. He just had to do what he thought was right.
There's obviously a huge interest from readers in this period of time. You're obviously very interested in that awful period in European history. Is this one of the examples of what historical fiction, something that happened back then, can tell us about some of the horrors going on in the world today? Why people are flocking to this?
Yeah, well, it's one of the reasons why I said overheated remark that I did about not liking historical fiction, because a really good novel is never about the past. It's got to be about now. And it's going to be about now whether it wants to be or not, in the same way that the great kind of technicolor 1950s movies about gladiators in Rome, they're all about America in the era in which they're being made. So a historical novel that's just about the past turns to ashes to me. But if you look at our own world now and you boil it down to some of the stuff that's going on, some of the stuff, like I'm 60, I never thought I would have to explain to my kids what fascism is, what ultranationalism is, what this level of religious hatred is, the contempt that there's going to be for the poorest people in the world who manage to get themselves in a boat and go somewhere else, which any of us would do. I mean, the othering of them for doing exactly what we would do if we had kids and we were looking for some kind of a future. That's all there in the 1940s. We've been down this road before. So it's not the purpose of a novel. The purpose of my novel or any good novelist's work is to be an experience of empathy and a page turner and hopefully beautiful and thrilling. But it's got to have somewhere in the DNA something to say about now. You know the song by the Smiths, Panic?
Yeah.
Hang the DJ, because the music they constantly play says nothing to me about my life. And that's true of all the art forms. If a novel has nothing to say to you about your life, it's not going to work.
There's one striking thing, even, you know, what's going on at the moment in the Ghosts of Rome, the conditions for ordinary Romans. By 1944, food is being used as a weapon in a time where people are dying of starvation. That really struck me when I was looking back on it this week.
It's all there, and sometimes, you know, stuff appears in novels because it's in the ether, and surprisingly sometimes a novelist or a musician or an artist or, you know, a journalist can sometimes know things they don't know. It just drifts in, you channel it in from the ether, and there's that resonance with things that are going on that you're going to see on the news tonight. And it, as I say, it's not the main purpose of a novel by any means, but if a novel doesn't have that, then it's not going to work. If it's just about the novelist, it's really not going to work. The great novels are never about that. James Joyce's Ulysses is not about a man wandering up and down the Liffey out there on a hot day in 1904. It's about all of us. And the same would be true of Evan Boland's poetry or Anne Enright's novels, Column to Beans, any of the great writers. They have some kind of universality that's able to tap into commonly held emotions and feelings.
The trilogy is almost complete, Joseph?
Yes, it is. I've just finished what I hope is the last draft of the third book, and it's called Lost Waters, and it'll be out in about a year. And then I'm never going to write a book about Nazis, popes, priests.
You say that.
Next time Ireland qualify for the Euros or the World Cup, I'm going to do that instead.
Well, hopefully that'll be next year. We'll see what happens there. Let's build up some points for you here now as regards your sporting life. You mentioned that your dad was a champion runner.
Yeah.
How far has the apple fallen from the tree in that regard?
Somebody once asked Oscar Wilde, "Do you ever play outdoor sports?" And he responded, "I have sometimes played dominoes outside cafes in Paris." And that's where it is with me. But I'm very proud of my dad and his sporting achievements. And
your family so generally. It stretches far beyond even your dad.
Yeah, no, it does. He had uncles who boxed, and, you know, but I think sport was very much a part of life in the Liberties when he grew up. He's a very fit guy. He wouldn't mind me saying well into his 80s, but he walks and exercises and does weights and all of that. And I go to the gym every other day to sculpt this perfect body that you see before you and to stand.
It doesn't just happen.
No.
Did your lack of interest in rugby in Blackrock College cause you any problems there?
No, I have to say it didn't. No, I found myself four or five other misfits, and we were tolerated and regarded with kind of bemused bafflement. That
takes all sorts to build a world.
Never had any grief about it. You had to play rugby until you were 15, as far as I recall, and then you had to play at some level. In my case, the F team, and then you could give up, and they felt sorry for you that you were missing the sport that had so much to teach about life. But there wasn't any hassle about it, no.
Your all-time sporting highlight, Joseph, it's got to be the World Cup Diaries, right?
It's got to be the World Cup Diaries, and it's got to be that day. I mean, apart from, you know, I would have, as anyone who's a parent, would have sporting memories that are to do with your children. I mean, I can remember, like, my son James in his teens was a good basketball player. We lived in the States. We lived in New York one year, and I was teaching at Baruch College in 23rd Street in Manhattan. It was a very hot summer. And going down late at night, given James was only kind of 12 or 14, going down at midnight to the basketball court on 6th Avenue, and there'd be 40, 50, 60 lads there playing basketball. And the confidence that James would have walking up to one of them and saying, can we shoot a few hoops? And they say, man, you know, you're in, where are you from? Straight away, 5 seconds later, they'd be bouncing the ball and taking shots. And just the love that you feel for your child, obviously, but that sport would allow that to happen. What other way is there that you just walk up to somebody and you're making friends straight away? You know, my son Marcus, he's a student in Oxford, he's rowing as part of his life at University College Oxford. And the thought that he gets up at 5 o'clock in the morning, perhaps after a night of refreshment, to go out and row the river, you know, it's just a lovely thing. So, I mean, my big sporting highlights would be to do with the personal. But if I could go in the time machine and experience one couple of hours again, it would, of course, be Italy. Ireland versus Italy. Well, on that great day.
You know, you stumbled onto a major story at that Ireland-Italy game. Because you tell the story of meeting a young Irish fan who'd gotten a little carried away with himself, ran onto the field after the Ireland-Italy game, and then got a few thumps from the NYPD before being charged with tumultuous behaviour for no apparent reason. So that young man in your piece was called Brian O'Byrne, a struggling young actor when you caught up with him in 1994. Here's a quick excerpt from your diary. Mr. O'Byrne describes to me being concussed and regaining consciousness a few moments later, only to find Jack Charlton standing there in all his glory, interceding with the coppers on his behalf. I wasn't sure it was Jack at first, he says, but then I saw his hair flapping in the breeze. And, I mean, nobody has hair that flaps in the breeze the way Jack's does. Poor Mr. O'Byrne will certainly remember the Italy game. So it got us thinking, what the hell happened to young Brian O'Byrne, the struggling actor who suffered that concussion? We did a little digging, and it turns out that that young actor is now one of the biggest Irish actors in the world, having been nominated for 5 Tonys, an Emmy, and was last seen in the brilliant Conclave, we're back to the Vatican, last year. So this is Brian F. O'Byrne.
This is Brian F. O'Byrne.
And what a story.
I'm sure none of that compares with Ireland 1, Italy 0.
Well, not his central role in it, apparently.
Were you aware of this connection?
We had friends in common. And I think I had met him before that night, but I think I met him in a bar in New York later that night, and he told me the story. I've been taken to the cells under the pitch.
There are photographs of him being led away, and it is actually very recognisable when you see the images of him.
He's got dyed green hair, but you can still
dyed green hair. But yes, that's what became of that young hooligan.
So, Brian, if you're listening, we need you this show.
What a guest anyway, even without this story.
I don't know how, but we are tracking you down.
We've got to hear more. You're more than welcome to appear on Second Captain Saturday. Just a couple more things before we get to ranking you here in your sporting life.
Sure, I'm only getting warmed up.
I know.
I realize, far from knowing nothing, I'm actually...
This is what I'm saying. This, you know, a no to other guests.
You have worked a miracle, exactly. Gentlemen.
You... A weekend at an artist retreat in Monaghan where a football match went awry.
Yes.
I'm hearing something about this. What happened there? This could be a runner-up for your sporting highlight.
It's the great place. The Tyrone Guthrie Centre for Writers and Artists at Anna McCarrick. And it must be 30 or 35 years ago. I may be being creative. It may be even longer. And there was a late night drinking session. I'll call it what it was. It was a drinking session. It wasn't a discussion about iambic pentameter. It was drinking. And went on all night, and somebody suggested at dawn, why don't we all have a kick about outside? And this crew of still drunken, not even hungover, sculptors and haiku composers and traditional singers and novelists amassed themselves into two teams and we kicked the ball around. There's a kind of a raised field outside the house in Anna McCarrick with a 6-foot slope, stark slope down to the gravel. So I very manfully in the spirit of Millwall, ran to stop the ball going over the gravel, slipped, fell over the slope and broke my ankle in two places. The first memory I have is of Colm Tobin laughing at me. I said, that's what you get for pretending, you know. And then he very graciously and kindly drove me to Monaghan Hospital where they put my leg in a cast and then it had to be broken again. And it went on and on and on. So I've suffered, gents. I've suffered for my football.
Joseph, you have put together a strong case for top spot today, I got to say. Murph, we're almost ready. Our current leader for 2025 is Spider Stacey of the Pogues on 74 points. Literary targets to bear in mind here from previous seasons include Anne Enright on 72 points, Colm Tobin on 75, and the high bar is the great Richard Ford on 85 points, as you mentioned earlier on. Murph, please now rank this sporting life of Joseph O'Connor.
You don't understand. I could have had class.
We don't have stars in this game, Mrs. Weaver.
What do you have, then?
People like me.
I could have been a contender. I could have been somebody.
Well, Joseph, it's been a pleasure listening to you over the last hour or so, and it seems almost rude to now ruthlessly, callously pick apart your sporting pedigree. Almost. I will now assess your sporting ability, pick a sports person that I feel most closely resembles you and your sporting achievements, and then, having considered your all-time sporting highlight, give you points out of 100 to see if you will be crowned our greatest non-sportsperson sportsperson of 2025. That is my job. That is what I must do. First of all, breaking your leg at a rider's retreat in Monaghan shows an admirable passion for the game of football. But perhaps you loved it, not wisely, but too well. The fact that you neglected to mention that your leg was broken by a disgusting over-the-top-of-the-ball challenge from Anne Enright just shows that you've got a bit of class about you. I don't know why you're protecting her. That UCD-UL rivalry has gotten really bitter over the years. Your all-time sporting highlight, Pros Laureate of USA 94, will take a lot of beating. And your ability to overcome crippling obstacles, the fact that you really didn't want to go, reminds me of no one more than world's number one golfer, Scottie Scheffler. Says that golf gives him no pleasure in life, wins the Open five days later. Talent, it's a curse. Ireland's greatest sports writer, Con Hoolan, once said that he missed Italia 90. He was in Italy for it. But reading your diaries this week, I felt like I was at USA 1994. There can be no greater gift than to bring your readers to the heart of a sporting event they would dearly love to be at. So for that reason alone, I'm giving you 78 points, good enough for an early season lead. Joseph O'Connor, this has been your sporting
I would have gone higher, but Murph is the authority on this.
I don't think it'll ever sink in. Thank you very much.
Well, in honour of your
over
time.
Over the moon.
In honour of your time at USA 94 and the magic moment you shared with those Irish fans on the streets of Orlando in the hours after the dream came to an end against Holland, we should probably play out with a bit of Thin Lizzy. What do you think?
Why not?
Round of applause, please. Joseph O'Connor, you've been brilliant. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. Thank you. When I passed you
in the doorway, well, you took me with you. Dancing in the Moonlight by Thin Lizzy, as described by Joseph O'Connor in his World Cup diaries in 1994, the night Holland beat Ireland in the last 16 and the two sets of fans come together as one. It's a wonderful moment. Somehow the song lifts the whole night. The fans are embracing each other. The laughing voice of Phil Lynott reminding us in some weird, intangible way that being Irish always has its consolations. So we lost. Big swinging deal. It's not the end of the world. Everyone is singing together now. Dancing in the Moonlight. It's got me in its spotlight. It's all right. Man can write, Murph. I think we've established that over the last hour or so. By the way, Breen F. O'Byrne, we're not kidding around here. We want you to appear on the show next week. Give us the full story from Giant Stadium. Let's make this happen, Murph.
I mean, we've put the call out as plainly as we can.
Yeah, you can listen to Murph and I in the Second Captains podcast with the rest of our team from Monday to Friday, wherever you get your pods, or through secondcaptains.com, where you can also hear the Second Captains produced international podcast series Where is George Gibney and Steak Knife. And if you want to hear more Joseph O'Connor, check out Dublin, One City, Many Stories, a new 6-part series made by the Irish Writers' Centre with UNESCO. You'll find that on RTE.ie. We're back here next week, same time. This is a Second Captains production for RTE, produced by Killian Down. Mark Horgan is the series producer for Second Captains. Our thanks to Johnny Lanagon in RTE. Thank you, Murph.
Thank you, Owen.
Thanks very much for listening. We'll talk to you next week.
Second Captain, First Captain, whatever.